So hello everybody and welcome to this recovery story. My name is Anna Dushinsky. I am the co-founder and the course director of the therapeutic coaching course along with Alex Howard. And I spent many years as director of the psychology for the Optimum Health Clinic as well. And I'm here today with Naomi Dake, who is a life coach and a consultant, and I know through our therapeutic coaching course, actually. So Naomi's here today to share her recovery story of going through chronic fatigue and coming out the other end. And when I first asked Naomi to do this, her response in typical modest fashion was to say, well, you know, if you think it's of any use, sure. But actually, I do think that even though it may not be the most dramatic story ever, it highlights some really key areas in terms of the kinds of patterns that are absolutely typical in leading to chronic fatigue. And specifically with you, Naomi, I feel like you've really gone deep to not only understand that those patterns were running, but also to understand the roots of those patterns and where a lot of that came from. So anyway, so welcome, Naomi. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you.
So your kind of chronic fatigue official journey, I suppose, although obviously, like many people, you'd had years and years, I suppose, of building towards it, began sort of towards the end of August 2018. Can you tell us what was going on?
Yeah, sure. So it had been a bit of a strange year, actually, 2018. I'd started it in Madrid, actually, on a New Year's trip. So beginning of January, and it just had the most horrible virus that I think I'd experienced so far in my life. Which from that point, actually for the rest of the year, never seemed to improve. It didn't really actually seem to feel much better. Some days would be better than others, but generally I'd have an unwell feeling most days. Okay. Meanwhile, what was going on, I was really busy from a work point of view. I was working.
And I think that's an understatement, actually, having looked at what you were actually doing.
Absolutely. So I was working officially 4 days a week, doing a busy consulting role, traveling a lot of places around the country, managing quite a difficult team and program of business change for a transformation program. And the team was spread around the UK, and there were lots of different site visits. So it meant a lot of early starts, late finishes, long days. And it was quite political, and you know, in the corporate environment that we know, it was quite challenging a lot of the time, and quite stressful. I don't think I realised probably until we got to the August quite how stressful it had been when I eventually stepped away from it. But there'd been a number of things from a work point of view. At the same time, I'd realised that I needed to do something that was more meaningful. And a few opportunities came up, which I took on, in addition to the role. And they were voluntary roles. So it will come out many times, I think, in our conversation, but I love animals. So I was volunteering to help out at an animal charity, basically. One day a week I'd go up and help out. I'd also become a trustee for a different animal charity, and I was volunteering as a mentor for other charities to offer my kind of professional skills and experience to help them and mentor them with their organisational improvements. In addition to that, I'd trained previously to become a life coach, because again, kind of nudges inside had told me that it was time to do something different, to do something around where my passion was. And that was really helping people to make changes in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so I was drawn to life coaching. I did a qualification over a few years, and I then set up my own business, which I was running kind of, again, officially 1 day a week. But as we know, these sort of things spread, and there was probably a little bit more than that in there, really.
So you've already got, you know, so if we just look at that, and there's already some really interesting pieces there. We talk a lot at the OHC, as you know, about the boatload. You know, what's the kind of the loads on the boat that mean eventually that boat is inevitably going to sink? So if we look at that, just in terms of work, a huge, huge amount going on, a really full on, lots of travel, early starts, and presumably quite difficult to kind of have any real level of self-care within that environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then, I mean, and what was the motivation to take on all of the voluntary work? As you say, it sounds like there was a kind of nudge. There was something that wasn't feeling right. So tell me about that.
Yeah, hard to put exactly into words, but I think there was very much a kind of, felt like there was a gap, there was a lack missing somewhere that felt like I wasn't really making a difference. I was doing a busy job and I was doing it to the best of my ability, but it wasn't enough. It didn't feel, it wasn't fulfilling in that sense. It wasn't, I couldn't see and touch and feel the impact that it was having in the areas that I care about. So in helping people, in helping animals. And so it felt like I actually needed to do something different in order to kind of fulfill that. And so instead of taking something off, I just added more things on.
Absolutely. That, right? Which is, again, it's a story that we've heard. I mean, obviously, I've been doing this work for my own 20 years. And across that time, again and again, you know, people say, well, something wasn't quite right. I knew something wasn't okay. Or yes, there was a sense of something missing or a gap. And so it's almost as if we don't know how to do it differently. So we just do more of what we know. So if we're achievers and we tend to kind of put everything in, we're helpers and that's the way that we approach our lives, even with that recognition that something's off kilter, we tend to just try and achieve and help more. I totally understand your reasoning for moving towards things that felt more meaningful, but interestingly, actually, from the sounds of it, what you're actually doing was just adding more and
absolutely
more.
Absolutely. I was just stretching the kind of the capacity. I just felt that I don't even think it was a question of could I cope? Did I have the resources to do it? I think it was just, I'll do it. I'll find a way and I'll add it in. And there was always a kind of, it'll work out somehow. There was a sort of naive optimism that I would be able to cope with it. There wasn't really, because I don't think anything had actually ever stopped me before. I think there was a sort of faith that it would work out. If I wanted it enough and worked hard enough, it would work. I'd make it work.
Interesting mentality. So a certain way of approaching the world right there. And there's nothing negative in that necessarily. But I love this idea that nothing had stopped you so far. But knowing you a little and having talked to you, it does sound that, you know, with the benefit of wonderful 2020 hindsight, there were quite a lot of clues in your physical background as well.
Yeah.
But it wasn't all kind of perfect.
No, it was far from it. And I think, obviously, as you say, with the benefit of hindsight, it's a lot clearer. And I can see, you know, goodness, why wasn't I going to crash with all of that? And there'd been, you know, a history of years of recurring infections, which eventually was diagnosed as interstitial cystitis. I'd had years all the way through my teens and 20s with endometriosis, which obviously a chronic pain condition. And that was really draining and meant probably about five or six surgeries over my 20s. Which I realise now was obviously significant trauma for the body to go through.
Yeah.
For me at the time, it was solving a problem that I clearly didn't realise the impact that was kind of all adding up to.
Interesting. So again, picking up on some of your language, you know, nothing stopped me so far, and I would find a way, and you know, operations were just solving a problem. Almost sounds like that was just facilitating you being able to carry on. Being able to kind of get on with the way that you wanted to approach things. And what kind of, as you've had time to reflect on that, what was that approach to life? What was your mentality at that point in time?
Yeah, I think from probably being quite young, there'd been a mindset of trying to do my best, and trying to succeed, trying to be good, be a good person and do well at the things that I was committing to. So I guess, you know, knowing now, there was definitely a lot of achiever and perfectionist stuff going on in there, patterns playing out. And I think for me, there's always been a helper pattern of putting other people's needs above mine. And I think that probably goes right back to sort of the age of 4 and 5, when, you know, family dynamics changed. So there was this sort of desire to kind of please people and to do well and to, you know, be the best that I could be. And for me, that meant in every area that I would try and do well. And career was an area that I could tangibly try and do that, which had been a continuation from school and college and university and so on.
So from that early age, it sounds like, as you say, when family dynamics changed and perhaps there was less attention available, less time available for you as that little girl, and your parents were under a fair amount of pressure and stress, I think, at that point. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so at the age of 4, my brother was born, my younger brother, and he was born with Down syndrome. So obviously quite a lot of emotional difficulty, pressure. You know, my mum and dad had to figure out how to manage that for the first time. It was obviously a lot less common there, and there was a lot less support around, and they didn't have close family nearby. So I think for all of us, there was a lot going on. For me, I stepped in. I saw a need. I picked up on a need somehow to help out and to kind of try and make my mum's life a lot easier and take some of that pressure off and help her day to day with my brother. And you know, it was great to have him. You know, we have a really good relationship. We get on brilliantly. And we fought as siblings, obviously, as kids do. But yeah, I recognise in hindsight now, looking back, that I think at kind of 4, 5, 6 years old, I grew up very quickly and probably stopped being a kid. And there's a sort of mental image of putting the toys away and, you know, it's kind of time to be responsible and grow up at that point, which, you know, you look at kids now, friends' kids at that age, and it's so young. So I can see now, you know, there wasn't a lot of, as you say, space and time to and probably didn't feel that it was the right thing to do to kind of put my needs out and to talk about what I needed, when I could see that my mum was struggling, trying to keep everything going in the house and with my brother.
Yeah, I mean, it's real sensitivity that kids have, don't they, to recognising the patterns and what's playing out. And of course, our personality types, the way, you know, our makeup almost, we talk on the course a lot about, you know, Enneagram and all of these kind of aspects of self. But for you, your response to seeing that need wasn't to kick up and shout louder, but actually the opposite was to kind of be that good girl, as you've already said. And really interesting what you say about your needs, in the sense that, you know, being that good girl sounds like even at that point of crashing 2018, you're being the good girl. You're trying to support everyone's needs at a different level. Yeah. Maybe that's now work and saving the planet and caring for the animals, but it's still that same kind of mentality. And of course, there's something very beautiful about that and really lovely. So people kind of go, well, can we not be helpers? Or isn't that a wonderful pattern to have? And of course it is. What we always end up saying is, but it's about the sustainability. And the key piece that you've picked up on there is that really there was no place for your needs as that kid. And that's no fault of anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I know, yeah, you feel that very much. But that at that point in time, there was no place for your needs. And it sounds like one thing that really struck me as you were talking is that sense of, oh, you know, the operations were just a kind of solving a problem.
Yeah.
That sounds like a quite disconnected place to have been.
Absolutely.
From your own physical, emotional experience.
Yeah, it really was. When I look back, I mean, there's a moment that sticks in my head when we were on the 90-day program with the clinic, and we did an exercise in there about rating the mind-body relationship with each other. So how would the mind rate the body and vice versa? And it was a real light bulb moment for me, because I'd never even thought about it that way. I'd never even thought that the two things would potentially be disconnected, or and when I got in touch then at that point with my body, it was just terrified that the mind was going to run the show and wasn't going to listen. It was going to be ignored. And how were we ever going to bridge these two things back together? And at that point, it really struck me that I need to do something different here, because my body isn't just a kind of a vehicle to kind of keep living the way I wanted to live or the way I was living, which interestingly turns out not to be the way I want to live.
Interesting.
But yeah, it was really the sort of wake-up call that I think I needed to say, oh my goodness, you know, instead of blaming my body for kind of failing me, which, you know, I think that's what I had been thinking up until maybe that point, couldn't understand what was going on and why it wasn't working properly. And it really started to shift it to, you know, a huge amount more respect for my body, and that the mind needed to support that and kind of get on the same team effectively as my body to make this work differently.
It's shocking, isn't it, that of course the way that we are brought up, I suppose, there isn't often a recognition that the body is the seat of communication. I remember it myself going through my own recovery and kind of reading a book and going, oh, yeah, that's age 19, no one told me that before, you know. But this idea that our body is the seat of our emotions, our instincts, our wisdom, if you like, and that it's a very important connection, and that for many people, for whatever reason, disconnection happens over time, partly because they aren't aware that connection is necessary, which is kind of what you're saying to some extent, but also because of various situations in your situation, because suddenly your needs didn't feel as important and you could see that everything else seemed more urgent and important than you felt at that moment. Other people, it can be because, you know, the body doesn't feel safe or the emotions don't feel safe and there's not a lot of holding or meeting. But that disconnect, and as you say, so then you can kind of see the schism over time, right? You know, through that experience through your 20s. And by the time you hit 2018, in August 2018, that really, even though you're getting recurrent infections, your sense is, no, well, we'll just, you know, keep going. This is what we want. This is what we're going to do. And there's no real sense of that communication or really hearing the message that your body was trying to give you, and that you were tired, you were getting recurrent infections.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it literally just hits a brick wall at the end of August. And I thought, okay, yeah, I'm probably going to need to have a week off or something here, and, you know, maybe a couple of weeks, and just, you know, I'll be okay. But of course, it just didn't go that way. It didn't get any better. And that was a new thing, actually. So in the past, I'd been able to get a little bit of improvement from having a bit of a rest, taking things easier, you know, doing the usual sort of antibiotics routine and you know, paracetamol and so on. And it just, that none of that stuff worked, and the fatigue wasn't going away, the headaches, the flu symptoms, they were just, it felt as though, my goodness, there's something really wrong here. And I actually felt quite worried. I thought, what have I done, what's happening? And that's when I started to read around and started to research around the kind of the bladder information side, and started to connect the dots to chronic fatigue, which was something I hadn't come across before. I'd heard of ME, but I hadn't connected that might be what was going on. Yeah. And I think there was some associations I had with it, and thought, my goodness, this is actually something that's really quite wrong if that's where I am and that's what's going on.
So as you say, hitting the wall and a real, I guess, a wake-up call at that point.
Right. A wake-up call, but without the answers. And I think there was something's quite wrong here that I can't fix. And the doctors don't seem to know what's really going on either. So the process of elimination of all of the blood tests, but nothing was really showing. But I knew in myself something was wrong. And so on the back of that, I decided to look around and just find out what was this chronic fatigue thing, what was it about, and stumbled on the clinic's website. And for me, that was a real turnaround point, because for the first time there was hope that there was an acknowledgement that this is what could be going on and that it affects lots of other people, but also that there was a sense of hope that people were there to support and that people had recovered from similar things and worse. So there was hope that by making some changes, which I didn't know what they were at that point, I could maybe find a way through this.
Which is lovely to hear. And it's interesting, yeah. You know, I've been around for a long time in this world, and how much more, or how much quicker people are finding the resources they need now to be able to find those answers. You know, it used to be that people would be searching for years, and now it's lovely to hear that, you know, in beginning that search, you can quite quickly look into what it is that you need going forward. Interesting as well what you say there, in the sense that well, first off, what it took to get you to the point of going, actually, something is not quite right, which again is a common theme, you know. But also, I suppose, reading around it and understanding a bit more about chronic fatigue, perhaps being able to join the dots that things have not been quite right for really quite a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a way forward potentially with that, right?
Yeah, definitely. And the whole clinics approach from the outset, from the information, from the kind of the initial chat, solving the puzzle, just felt exactly like that's where I am. I'm starting to see that there are all of these pieces, and I'm starting to see how they're starting to come together, and they're starting to make sense now. When I started to reflect back on previous physical health, previous stress, but, you know, things like adrenals, what would be going on with my energy, it all then started to add up and started to make sense of, okay, there actually is something that this is, and there's a way of dealing with that. Because I think for years there'd been a feeling that something wasn't right, but I didn't know what it was and wasn't getting any answers anywhere.
So in terms of that journey, and it's been a real life-changing journey for you to go through that, as it is for most people, we talked a little bit about the kind of recognition that I'm sure came through that exploration of where some of those patterns had come from. What do you think were the biggest kind of aha moments? One of them obviously was this connection to the body. You had one. That was a good thing to acknowledge. What else, you know, what else began to click into place? I suppose we're talking, you know, because it's my speciality, particularly around the kind of psychology, emotional side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, doing the 90-day program, the concept of boatloads made an awful lot of sense, and reading about the achiever and the helper patterns, you know, really, really resonated strongly with me. And I started to realize there's something a bit more going on here, that goes back a long way. I think also in the sessions that I then had one-to-one with Nikki, who'd facilitated our 90-day program, were real light bulb moments, I think, in every session, because she helped me to see that there was a lot of healing needed around the sort of inner child part. As you mentioned, the sort of childhood bit where I didn't have the space or didn't feel okay to kind of focus on my needs and have those met and held at that point. That was a big piece, I think, understanding that. I think understanding the Enneagram, the spiral dynamics, I think that all really helped to make sense of, okay, that's where I'm at. That's why, you know, I can't solve this by trying to solve it the way that, but by trying to address it the way that it had been caused. I couldn't just fix this in the way that previous situations probably had been resolved more traditionally or more medically.
It's a really interesting piece as well, in the sense that, I mean, what you bring up there is so key. If you think about that kind of that younger you, to some degree, it worked, right? Being that good kid, caring for your brother, looking after your mum's needs. As you say, we create these patterns, not really just randomly, but because to some degree they work. And you know, being that good girl, achieving, helping, creates a certain identity, makes us feel a certain way, and is to some degree fulfilling. Even if it's not fulfilling our deepest layer needs, there is something that that does do for us, and therefore we begin to replicate that. That becomes the pattern, the model in which we work in the world. And so, yeah, really interesting to begin to suddenly go, actually, achieving and helping is not going to get me out of this. That logic, that way of approaching things is not going to be what solves this. Something fundamentally change.
Absolutely. And I realized exactly that I had to flip it on its head, and I had to let go of the attachment to outcomes. And I didn't have the energy to go and help people and do all the things I wanted to. So I had a choice, and I thought, I can either get really frustrated by that, which is just going to drain my energy further, or I could really start to think, how do I need to show up and be differently in the world? Because I do still have this desire to make a difference, and I do still have this desire to help people, and I don't think that's ever going to go away, because I think that's part of me. But what I've realized is that in order to be able to do that, I have to do that from a place of being full, being kind of fulfilled and well and having energy. And the only way I'm going to do that is if I take care of myself and start to show myself that self-compassion that I hadn't for such a long time. You know, it had been very common that the inner critic would kind of drive and push and, you know, tell me I wasn't quite doing enough. You know, hence, you know, doing 3 ridiculous voluntary roles on top of everything else. But I realized that if I really did want to make a difference, it had to be sustainable. It had to be, I had to look after myself first, which I had to go on a bit of a journey with, because initially, of course, it felt selfish. So I had to work on that and reframe my beliefs and my thinking around it to realize that the only way I was going to be able to give would be to kind of fill myself up first. And it sounds ridiculous, but I had to work out what I enjoyed and what gave me energy. And you know, I realized in that 3-4 month period that I was off after my crash, I was off work completely, everything went on pause. I realized that actually being out in nature, even if it was 5 minutes a day, was essential for me to ground and connect to something else and get out of my head. And it helped me to connect more with my body, actually, as well as learning things like meditation and EFT and using some of the tools that we'd used on the 90-day program, stop process, and you know, starting to put those things into practice. They really helped, but I wouldn't have been able to do that if I was still hanging on to and doing the things I was doing previously. I had to almost have that complete break.
And that's interesting as well, isn't it? And also it sounds like that it was, which I think is often true, we always talk about having to working with clients to figure out the roadmap, to figure out what it is that's going on, because often it is that kind of fundamental shift of perspective that needs to happen to then allow you to create the changes that need to be put in place. And that need, you know, we need follow through there as well, but we also need that aha moment of it clicking that something's got to change. And interesting what you're saying in terms of the help of the achiever. I said before, you know, people say often, well, yeah, they're not bad things intrinsically, and they're not, of course, they're great qualities. The key is that balance, isn't it? And I love what you say there, in the sense that it's about where it comes from. It's coming from a place of lack, and in a way, if we think back to your childhood, I'm kind of making some assumptions here, but in a way, if your needs aren't being met because it's impossible to have them met at that point in time, you try and find ways to have them met. Then achieving and helping become how you get your sense of kind of validation and sense of self, as opposed to that authentic piece. Also really interesting what you said in terms of the on that theme of disconnection, you really have to start figuring out what you need, what do you what do I need to feel good, to be happy, to be fulfilled. And as you say, that being possibly at points quite different to what you had thought it might be.
Completely. I think I do feel like my values either changed or significantly reordered. Because I realized that I none of the things that I want to do are going to be possible if I don't have my health and if I don't look after it. And I think it had really given me, as you said before, a complete wake-up call to say, you can't take this for granted. You need to actually, you know, actively pay attention and take care of this, because nobody else is going to, and it's nobody else's responsibility, it's mine. And if I want to be able to make a difference and live a kind of life that I want to live, then it's only going to, it's in my hands to do that, and I have a different way of living, a slower way of living that just wasn't the fast-paced travel around everywhere and go and solve problems. It was never going to be that, that kind of was the way through. I think having the life coaching certainly helped me, because a lot of what we touched on made sense because it fitted with the ethos of that. And I think there was a bit for me of, I can't actually sit here and help clients to do this and say this to clients if I'm not prepared to really look at myself.
Just tweaking that helper pattern a little bit, you know, prodding that aspect, really nice. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, because it is a complete mindset shift, isn't it? And as you say, quite challenging to have to go back and literally reassess almost the model of the world that that you created as that young child. And as you say, to challenge some of those ideas about, you know, belief systems, values, what is it to be selfish, what is it to be useful, all of that. And also, I suppose, we've spoken a little bit, but one of the things that we've talked about a little bit is that it can often feel, and I hear this with lots of people, a bit disloyal to go back and question and to recognise that through no fault of the situation or the people necessarily, but just the limitations of that situation, that our needs weren't met. And to be able to hold that space for ourselves can be pretty challenging too, can't it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, going on, I'm incredibly grateful for the clinic, because I think that was my turning point into recovery and into healing. And I think it's also given me a way into doing the therapeutic coaching course with yourself. And learning from kind of fellow students on the course has been massively helpful in being able to go back and look at some of those childhood patterns and programs and situations and recognize that it's okay to say my needs weren't met and my parents did the best they could. It's not by saying that my needs weren't met that they were doing a bad job, or that, you know, they neglected me at all. You know, that's just wasn't the case, but clearly at the time they had other bigger demands on their time, which, you know, I can recognize, absolutely. But at the same time, I just didn't have the opportunity to be a kid in the same way, I don't think. And I can look back now and feel sad and compassionate for my young self, but also, you know, feel empathy with my mum in particular in that situation and see what she was going through. But at the same time, it's all of that together that was going on, and kind of relearn to kind of almost parent myself. And you know, Nikki taught me a really great resource, actually, in a podcast called The Adult Chair. And that's been, you know, such a learning to really understand what it's like to sit in your younger self, and you know, how do you grow through that, and how do you establish yourself in your healthy adult, in your higher self, and what does that mean?
It's probably the biggest challenge for us as human beings, right? Because we either carry the patterns of what's gone on in the history and don't really think to challenge them. Because, you know, we weren't beaten or neglected or starved, and they were loving humans. So there often isn't a reason to question it until there's a reason to question it, right?
Absolutely.
Or equally, people get very caught in being very angry or blaming of, and that can be in itself, that can be cathartic if it's a part of a process, but if it's where you get stuck, it's problematic too. So a huge amount of this, I think, is owning these different aspects of ourselves, isn't it? But from that adult space, from that integrated adult of being able to hold the space for all of these parts of ourselves, for the young part, for the part that recognises and empathises with, you know, with the parents and what they went through. Yeah, it's holding all of that together, which is quite certainly a learning process, isn't it? And it's fairly complex, and I think an ongoing one as well, right?
Oh, absolutely.
End point to that.
Absolutely. I mean, I can see, you know, if I look back at it through that lens, I can see that sense of belonging was what I was looking for at that age, and And that went then all the way through school into, you know, school friendships and the kind of the bullying and all of that that then plays out because you're the quieter, sensitive kid who is just trying to fit in somehow and trying to be loved, I think, you know, looking back at that, just wanted to be accepted, but didn't really know, I think looking back, I didn't really know who I was at that point, because I think I'd just been so so caught up in the kind of family dynamic and didn't really know who I was or what I stood for, and I'm sure probably you know, came across as you know, a really quiet, shy kid who, you know, how do you engage with her, because she's she's almost not quite sure of herself.
And it sounds like that's been a big part of the process, is I mean, not that that purely began at the point that you crashed, obviously, but that learning of yourself, that owning of yourself, is something really key and so powerful to be able to kind of see it all with the clarity that you now see it.
Yeah, it does. It really does make a difference, because I think if anything, just by sharing it, you maybe allow other people to see that, you know, if they can relate to it or if it resonates with somebody in some way, whether that's a client or a friend or somebody else, it's massively helpful, I think, that they can see that you've been through something and you understand it. And that was one of the biggest benefits for me of the you know, working at the clinic, because there were people who'd been through it, there were people who could relate to it firsthand, and that was massive. And I think if I can help people in that same way, to be able to give them something that normalizes what they're going through and you know, just kind of says, you're not on your own, that, you know, I can relate to that, there are other people who've been through something similar. Obviously, you know, journeys are unique, but it just, I think, makes you feel less alone with it and less strange.
Well, right. I mean, and as you say, I think journeys are unique, and there are commonalities and themes, and, you know, we have certain experience. You talk about that reparenting of the self, and to some degree, kind of having someone hold the space for you is the beginning point often of recognizing that you can do that for yourself as well. Because if that has been missing, which it has for a lot of people, then how do we know how to model that? How do we know how to create that for ourselves? Whereas someone holding that space for us, I think, can be very powerful and going, oh, okay, this is what this feels like, to be listened to be met, to be held. And now I can internalize that. I can begin to do that for myself as well, which of course is where those big shifts come, right?
It's when
you are being that for yourself. It's you can hold that space for yourself, which is obviously...
Yeah. And you really don't think that will be as powerful as it actually is. You know, when somebody says, you know, you hold the space for yourself, you think, but I'm with myself all the time. What does that mean? It's only when you learn how to do that and kind of then do it for yourself that you think, oh my goodness, wow, actually, okay, that works. That, you know, I feel calmer in my system and I feel safer, and you just feel more grounded and less, you know, less all over the place. You just feel, you know, it's quite empowering to be able to do that for yourself and not have to, you know, at any time that you need it, and not have to rely on other people. But, you know, obviously there's times and places where you need other people.
Absolutely. And I think that, again, it's a balance, isn't it? Saying, of course, it's about where we come into those relationships, right? If we come from a place of knowing that we can hold that space for ourselves, we're not in that place of desperation, of desperately wanting or needing, which is, again, one of the hallmarks of often, as we grow up without that, we'll often try and seek it externally, partly through what we do or through helping, and partly also through relationships, which is not always the most balanced or sustainable either, is it? So that leads us rather neatly into what now? Because I know for many people, they kind of go through this journey and completely abandon everything that they were doing before and shift completely. But actually for you, at least partly, you're already on a path that felt good in terms of the coaching. So where do we see, find you now as you've come through that journey and all of that inner exploration? Where has it brought you to at this point?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think at the time of the crash, I think I did shortly after that mentally start to make my transition into the next part of my life, or the next part that I wanted it to be, and recognized what was important and what was a way for me to live. How did I want to live? What did I want to be? What did I want my life to be about in the kind of second half, hopefully? So I think I mentally started making shifts then, but physically, in terms of lots of other things going on in and around my life, meant that I didn't make any sort of immediate massive change other than kind of reducing my days. But what I do now is I put my energy into different places. So my energy is going into my business, and that's ramping up to become full time. So my coaching and hopefully later in the year, therapeutic coaching as well, will be part of that. The corporate world is something I'm leaving behind right now. And for me, I'm starting to really honour who I am and my values. I'm starting to work with charities whose values I can relate to. And I'm working with a huge amount of different clients who I think are on a similar wavelength or need things that I've learned to build over the last few years. So self-confidence, self-belief, self-awareness, emotional connection, the things that I've had to learn, I've realized I can now help other people with. So that's been a big change. What else in terms of obviously the clinic, I'm really lucky to be able to do some work with them in their psychology team. So very excited about that. And that feels
in training right now.
Yeah, in training
with us as well. Absolutely. Which would be lovely. It's interesting what I hear in all of that is that word values and congruence. And again, it's not something we've really talked about, but obviously the dissonance, the kind of conflict perhaps in terms of what was really important to you, even though you may not have been consciously aware of that, and the world that you were living in terms of the work that you were doing.
Obviously, absolutely.
You attempted to make changes around that in terms of your volunteering, but actually, again, that's a really common theme. We've talked in the course about the fact that we often aren't consciously aware of our own values, a bit like we're often not consciously aware clearly of our own needs. They just kind of come out in feelings of disconnection, conflict, not feeling good either in ourselves or in the environment that we're in. And so it sounds like with that kind of inner alignment that you've really worked hard to achieve, you can now ensure that the world and the work that you now do is in kind of fits, really, is congruent with that for you.
Absolutely. And it feels so much better, you know, on every level. I think my intuition had been there for years, but I'd been ignoring it. And it now feels as though, the pieces are fitting back in the places that they should. And actually, interestingly, obviously the pandemic has been such a strange time for everybody, but my search for belonging has actually really helped me to solidify those roots in my local community and build relationships locally. Done a bit of street champion thing, helping out with neighbours through the pandemic. And it's actually my sense of belonging comes from not what I do, but just who I am, who we are in our local part of the world. And those things are actually really important now. And they not that I would ever have said they weren't and people weren't important, but I just didn't have the time to do that kind of thing when I was zipping up and down the country. But actually now those simple things, having a chat with the neighbour, spending time with the cat and, walking around to feed the donkeys, those sorts of things, simple things, just actually give me huge amounts of pleasure. And I think it's allowing myself to enjoy that. And I think that's a lot of the trying to get the inner critic and perfectionist back in balance and recognizing that inner child sometimes just wants to play and do fun stuff. And that's okay.
And, donkey, and that's okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
What a brilliant place to end that. that's our outcome is a bit more of that, a bit more of embracing those inner child places. But I think a lot of really, really significant kind of key themes there in terms of our connection or disconnection from self, where that comes from, and being able to trace that, really understand it, and the importance of that, the importance of refinding our sense of who we are, our values, and being able to be congruent then in terms of how we live that, and how all of that together builds health and happiness, well-being, all of these things. So thank you very much, Naomi, for sharing all of that, and for having this chat with me today. And thank you, everybody, for listening as well. Thank you.